CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs. The interregnum, the end of the Soviet Union until now. Gregory Copley reports on world order and afterwards. Gregory, if I understand it, this interregnum has been a period of inertia. No one group or no one empire is taking control. It's not, certainly not Pax Americana. There's too much disorder and disappointment in these 30 years. What does this tell us about the days up ahead of us? If this is the interregnum, what's next? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, in my latest piece is subtitled, Are We Already in the Inter-Pax Years? Because we moved from during the 20th century from Pax Britannica to Pax Americana. That Pax Americana started to unwind, if you like, with the end of the Cold War and progressively since then. We keep forgetting what this means. We talk about the rules-based world order, and that's thrown about as though it were some divine and universally agreed system of laws and governance for the entire world. But it's not. What we see is that it is literally at the moment, was Pax Americana. It was a world in which the rules of international trade, international stability, and so on, were written by Washington. Yes, they moved initially through the United Nations, which was a creature of the Allied victory of World War II, but pretty quickly, one of the key victors, the Soviet Union, was relegated out of that process. And so you saw that the global rules were devised and carried through as an extension of Pax Americana. Yes, you had the Soviets get a small regional Pax Sovietica, if you like, where they could control the Warsaw Pact countries and a few foreign countries around the world. But the reality was that we have only two times in history seen global Pax, a global peace dominated by a single power. One was Pax Britannica, which almost voluntarily ceded to Pax Americana. But we forget what it took to get there, because it was the incredible buildup of U.S. and Western logistical capability during World War II, which led to the Western victory in World War II, where the U.S. was able to not only dominate the battlefield, but dominate the post-battlefield world, where you could control the supply chain, the trading arteries and mechanisms, and also provide a universally accepted currency for that trade to be conducted in. So now that is disappearing. We're seeing the decline of the U.S.-dominated rules-based world order. I also said in this article that the rules-based world order is presently in hospice care. And the question is, how do we recover from that? And in my discussions with senior U.S. officials, I have to say, look, do you remember how we saw the world reach this position? It was because the United States, with its allies, was able to achieve global maritime dominance,
yes,
global air power dominance, and initially global space dominance, even before space dominance became popular. Well, we saw President Obama, for example, decide that space dominance was too provocative, and he wanted to make it sure that the U.S. retained space superiority. But in fact, it declined even beyond that, and the People's Republic of China, and to a degree, Russia, post-Soviet Russia, had as equal or greater capacity to dominate the space environment, and therefore control of communications, surveillance, ultimately the global space mining and space energy collection and so on. So in order to restore the Pax Americana, the United States would need to once again be able to demonstrate that it had global maritime dominance, global air power dominance, the ability to intervene through terrestrial and space-based weapon systems, and and also to dominate space in such a way that it couldn't lose control of global surveillance, global communications and the like. And it's clear that the United States is not spending nearly enough to do that, nor does it have the political will or cohesion to achieve that. Even worse, the United States does not have a strategy, a national grand strategy, which would enable the cohesion of that. So we're seeing, as we saw in 1935, we saw the League of Nations, founded in 1919, break apart, and as the states began to ignore the then British-American global order and rushed into World War II. Today, we're seeing the decline in U.S. Or the U.S. rules-based world order, and we'll see with it the breakdown of those mechanisms, whether it's the UN itself or its component arms like the International Criminal Court, or the ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, all starting to lose their ability to enforce compliance to the World Trade Organization, perhaps the most important.
Does Beijing have an strategy, a concept of world order strategy? Is it following a course you can see?
Absolutely. There's no question that the Communist Party of China began studying this in the late 20th century and had started to create a national grand strategy by 1999. By 2018, September 2018, our late colleague Josef Berdansky highlighted this very succinctly in some articles about how Xi Jinping and senior Communist Party of China officials declared at the start of a new 30 years war against the United States. And they chose that name very, very deliberately, implying that by 2049, the PRC would dominate the world and there would be a new, quote, peace of Westphalia, bearing in mind that the peace of Westphalia had been the conclusion of the 30 years war, which ended in 1648. And the Peace of Westphalia defined the modern world, in a sense, the architecture of nation states fitting together and abiding by certain rules and conditions. And Xi Jinping said in September 2018, that the new Peace of Westphalia would be the new Peace of Beijing, in which Beijing would control the rules-based world order. So it has been, the Communist Party of China has been studying this with great detail. It has learned, it learned how the West, and particularly Britain and then the United States, built the current framework of global interaction, the rules-based world order. So it hasn't taken any of this for granted, whereas the West has forgotten what it took to get here. We thought we were rich and we're going to stay rich. We were going to stay in control because naturally we were the best. But that degree of hubris and smugness is bound in the end to undermine you as it is doing today, because the PRC knows what it's doing. It's not that the People's Republic of China is economically capable of surpassing the West economically. Quite the contrary, it's in massive terminal decline. But its goal is to ensure that it's the last man standing and that the West's economy and cohesion declines faster than the mainland China's cohesion and willpower. I don't believe that will occur. I believe that the PRC will implode before the West runs out of money, particularly the United States. The United States has much more resilience built into it, but the PRC is looking at how it can survive and prevail after the crash of its opponents. And the West's only response to that has been to look blankly at the situation and not understand it, whereas a coherent Western, and particularly U.S., strategic approach could quite clearly address the problem and respond quickly.
Does Beijing have a policy or a vision of how the Ukraine war comes out? Does it win in either direction?
You could argue that it wins in either direction because the war forced Russia into the arms of the People's Republic of China, which is something that Moscow certainly did not want. And it's an ironic reversal of how the West under Nixon in 1972 prized the subordinate communist power, then People's Republic of China, away from the USSR. And that led to the end of the USSR. Certainly, Moscow at that time retaliated against that incredible coup de main, which Nixon achieved. And Russia, or the Soviet Union, rather, was able to help destroy the Nixon presidency, even after his landslide re-election to the presidency. And they helped dramatically to get rid of Nixon as president of the United States. And but that actually didn't help the Soviet Union, because all it did was ultimately put Jimmy Carter in the White House, who continued to give Beijing advantages which Nixon would never have allowed. And that actually worked against the Soviet Union. But by then, the Soviet Union was in terminal decline anyway. But it set in train, as we discussed earlier, a situation where the unintended consequences of the Cold War are now playing out.
And the new Cold War that we're in now, this new Cold War, does it have advantages that the U.S. can take, can find, can seize, can use? Are there tools here left over from the old Cold War?
Well, there are tools, and the tool of containment is which worked against the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union broke after 1972. That tool is still possible for the U.S. to use against the People's Republic of China. However, that alliance of anti-Beijing states is being broken apart bit by bit. And the most significant fracture in that alliance, which is the alliance is known as the Quad of India, Japan, the US, and Australia, we're seeing India and the People's Republic of China doing deals to ensure, as far as Beijing is concerned, that India would not go to war with the PRC in the event that Beijing decided to declare war on Taiwan. We saw in the last week a meeting between the defense ministers of the PRC and India, bearing in mind that this occurred at the same time that Beijing refused to allow a meeting between the U.S. Secretary of State and the PRC Minister for Defense. So Beijing is actively working to break up the Quad and is having some success. It's also moving to replace Russian influence in Central Asia. We saw in Xi'an, at the same time the G7 summit was taking place in Hiroshima in Japan, Xi Jinping was conducting a summit with the five Central Asian heads of state in Xi'an, offering them improved trade with China and some modest investments from the PRC into Central Asia. And this is one of the few areas where the PRC is prepared to invest a few billion dollars in infrastructural development and loans, because elsewhere it's run out of money and cannot get its money back from the Belt and Road Initiative at all.
And
the
U.S. policy entertained now by the Biden administration of engagement, does that suit China's purposes?
Well, in engaging with whom? They're not engaging with Russia, they're not engaging with the PRC, and they're not engaging with those Central Asian states which actually would welcome greater cooperation with the West, because they need to trade with the outside world if they are not to once again be submerged under the control of either Moscow or Beijing or both.
So what we have right now is more interregnum, or has China asserted itself for Pax Sinica? Is that underway from Beijing's point of view?
Well, Beijing, yes, that's the end of the new 30 years war would be Pax Sinica. And of course, there was a Pax Sinica 2,000 years ago in the Han Dynasty, but that only gave China control of some parts of East Asia. They're looking now to make a global Pax Sinica. That's unlikely to occur, I believe, because it's a long reach from the present situation to replacing the West as the arbitrating mechanism for the entire world. I think what we're going to see is a long interregnum before a new Pax takes place. That's why I say we're in this inter-Pax era, which is going to be a period of considerable international uncertainty, the rise of middle powers, the rise of regional powers, and China would be one of those. But it's going to be a messy situation, a multipolar world, right, which is less likely to be stable and less free of conflict than periods of an overarching Pax Britannica or Pax Americana.
Let's head to something you can count on, Buckingham Palace, with the King Charles Report. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.